Yeah, we checked with our customer. He bought 300 of them, and that's exactly what he wants. No windows. And then that triggered something in our head. We can offer a better customer experience. So how do we do that?
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host John Ramstad takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
Today's episode is brought to you by our platinum sponsor, XTI Aerospace. They are powering the vertical economy, building a long-range VTOL, and you can find more at xtiaerospace.com. Now, please remember to like, comment, and share on this channel, and enjoy today's podcast. Everybody, welcome to the Hangar X podcast, and this is where innovators and investors and people that are changing the face of aerospace today come to get not only learn what's happening today, but get the information we need to make decisions moving into the future. So we'd love for you to like and subscribe and share this with a friend because, you know, today we're going to have an incredible conversation that I believe is an aircraft that could reset the curve on business aviation. You know what it does? I think it proves to the industry, especially traditional aerospace, you know what? We've been playing too small. We have not been thinking big enough, and we have Scott Drennan on today. Scott, I'm guessing you would agree with that statement.
Absolutely, and I love thinking big around this aircraft, and it does exactly what you say, John. You kind of rewicker your mind around it by focusing on what we'll talk about later is laminar flow and how to design an aircraft for it.
Yeah, so today, folks, we're talking about the Phantom 3500 from Otto Aerospace, and we just got back from NBAA, and it was the star of the show. Everybody wanted to be there and see this airplane. And while you were there, you announced you got an order of 300 firm orders here from Flexjet, which is just an exclamation mark on the work you've been doing. So you guys did a clean sheet design, laminar flow, and you're promising the industry an 18,000-pound business aircraft that has less than half of the fuel consumption. I can't imagine what the TCO, the numbers. Of course, that's why Flexjet is interested in this. So, Scott, I got to read your bio here for everybody who might not know you because you're a rock star. So you're president and COO of Otto. You're one of the most respected engineering leaders in modern aerospace, in my opinion. And so you built your career at Bell. You led advanced programs, innovation centers, flight research, and now at Otto, you're the steward of this bold bet on creating this laminar flow, clean sheet manufacturing, and it's work that began with Bill Otto's Solera. We'll talk about that a little bit, which was a demonstrator, and now you're building the 3500. And Scott, what I think sets you apart is this blend of engineering rigor, entrepreneurial courage, and the ability to translate complex aerodynamics into practical certifiable aircraft. And so with that, Otto's moving toward preliminary design, wind tunnel validation, composite breakthroughs, and you have this clear path for FAA certification. We're going to talk a little bit about that, which is fantastic. And you already have Flexjet's commitment for 300 aircraft. So, you know, first question is, you know, you're promising an aircraft with a 61% reduction in fuel burn from a business jet that looks nothing like that's out there today. Doesn't have windows. What's the first thing you want the audience to understand about what you and Otto are doing with this aircraft?
Yeah, I think you have to start with laminar flow. If you think about our mission, we want to bring the physics of laminar flow to bear on aircraft design so we reduce the energy required for flight. It's kind of simple that way. There's lots of talk about alternate propulsion systems out there today, and our philosophy is, you know what, if you want to do alternate propulsion, which is going to be heavier, you better get an airframe that's going to be lighter and require less energy of you. Now, we're using traditional propulsion, but laminar flow is where we should start. I'll expand on that a little bit. Laminar flow is the orderly flow of a fluid over a body. Think about those air molecules staying really close to the surface of the outside of the aircraft. Versus turbulent flow, which we fly in today, where the molecules are banging into each other. Some of them are going in the wrong direction, and there's a swirl there. The difference between those two is drag. And a laminar flow aircraft can achieve 5x better drag than a turbulent flow aircraft as you observe it locally in a section of the wing. And that drag reduction over the whole aircraft reduces the drag by 30%. And then that compounds: less drag, less thrust required, less drag, less fuel required. Well, less engine, less fuel, smaller structures. And now we get down to, and my engineers would kill me if I didn't correct the 18,000, 19,000. So okay. That's the limit. That's the limit of Part 23. We'll talk about that too. But you end up getting down to a 19,000 pound aircraft that can perform like 35, 40,000 pound aircrafts in the super mid business jet category. And it's we call that the virtuous cycle. So when you're synthesizing an aircraft in your conceptual design phases, that synthesis, if you're adding weight and performance, it tends to get away from you on the weight side. If you're reducing drag and weight, it tends to, you know, compound and help you on the good side. And that's what happens when laminar flow comes to play. You can imagine, you know, you say, well, Scott, if it's just 30% drag, shouldn't it just be 30% fuel burn? But it's on a logarithmic part of the curve, and that's why you get that compounding effect that results not only in a lighter aircraft, but as you know, John, aircraft economics go with max takeoff gross weight. So now we have an acquisition cost opportunity to pass on to our customers, a direct operating cost opportunity to pass on to our customers from less fuel burn to smaller engine reserves to single pilot operations. So it really is NASA, when they coined the term that laminar flow was the holy grail of aerodynamics many, many decades ago, they were right. It's just we're able to do it now, and we can't wait to bring it to bear on the industry.
Well, and also you get dramatically increased range. I was looking at some of your range numbers, 3,200 with four passengers fully loaded. That's impressive for this size aircraft.
Yeah, we'll come in there somewhere around that 3,000, 3,200 mile range. And the big thing is just get coast to coast, right? The super mids are known for getting coast to coast in North America with NBAA reserves, five souls on board, as you said. We can do that mission all day. And we're getting a little bit better as we speak and refine the sections on the wing and the analysis that we've been doing.
So this wing compared to, I don't want to call it, you know, competitors, but the other mid-sized jets, you know, Cessna, Gulfstream, Embraer, so this wing is 30 to 50% less drag overall based on the traditional wing designs that are out there today. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's even more than that. If you just do the wing, separate the system out, when you do it on a wing, you usually measure ML over D, Mach number times L over D, L over D being lift over drag. A major aerodynamic efficiency measure, it can be on the order of, you know, 6, 7, 8x better just in the wing. Now, that's not where all your drag comes from. A lot of it does, and you need it to perform very efficiently. But it's a whole nother world wing to wing. Aircraft to aircraft, it's a 30% reduction. But if you went wing to wing, it's a lot higher than that.
Well, yeah, and I'm guessing with no windows, this is also part of your drag, right? The parasitic drag, the form drag, all these drag factors, you're looking at every part of the whole drag equation.
Yeah, so laminar flow attacks what's called viscous drag. Viscous drag, the way to best think about it, it's the friction drag between the air and the skin. And when you look at the total drag buildup of an aircraft, the viscous drag is the largest component. So we attack that first. But your observation about another form of drag, excrescence drag, antennas, windows, steps, bumps, these things, waviness, it's a big deal as well. And you're hitting on why it's so fun to do this clean sheet. Because, yes, every aircraft designer is obsessed with drag, but you should see it around our house. it's incredible.
So it's an obsession.
Yeah. I mean, we do everything from somebody says, where's your pitot tube? Why isn't it up front here by the nose? And we say, why does it have to be? Can't we put it in the back where there's more turbulent flow so we don't disrupt our laminar flow? Where are your antennas? Why aren't they sticking out? Why don't I see the bump? And so why do they have to be? Can't they be embedded? I think military planes do that. I think we can make saddles and fiberglass covers so they can still see. So we think of everything, and at its core, how much laminar flow can we get? But drag becomes your prime enemy when you're thinking that way, and it's a great feeling to be innovative around it.
So, question for you personally, Scott. I mean, you've been involved in some of the most advanced programs, vertical lift programs at Bell, yep. other places. When you looked at this and Otto approached you and you said, oh my goodness, okay, I'm going to go bet the farm. I got to be part of building this. What was that? What made that a decision you had to do?
Yeah. So I was working for the New Vista Capital Company at the time, Dennis Muhlenberg's new capital company. I was one of his technical advisors. And Paul was as well, our CEO, Paul Tao. And we were looking at deals, all kinds of deals. And we saw this Otto thing and said, wow, we've got to go take a look. And the thing that sold me is when I arrived, I said, let me see the flight test data. And they had thermal imagery that proved to me there was laminar flow transition at a significant part of the wing in the fuselage measured. They had a thrust, an instrumented thrust plate on the back of that pusher prop and the turbo diesel they had. So I got thrust measurements off of all the flight regimes so you can back calculate the drag directly. And then the third thing was fuel burn. So it was this preponderance of measured data and the fact that a flight test program occurred over a 2-year period and that laminar flow was still on that aircraft. And all the, you know, kind of the rumblings of you can't keep laminar flow in there. And we'll talk about that too, what we do to even do that more. But that was the proof from the vehicle itself. Then I met a really cool, scrappy team out there. I mean, Dr. Otto had brought a bunch of people together that had the courage to build a piloted 9,000-pound aircraft to demonstrate all this. They built by hand every part of that aircraft except for five things: tires, brakes, avionics, propeller, and engine. They built all the rest. The forms for the tools, the hydraulics inside, the landing gear. So when I saw that combination, really cool technology, with a great team that I knew how to supplement to be more formal and certify and produce and everything. Plus, I love prototype teams. That's what I did a lot at Bell. We thought, that's it. We've got it. Now we just have to transform that product into a market space that's juicier. So that's why we went from the Celera to the Phantom 3500, where we're sitting right in the sweet spot of the business jet market.
Yeah, and, you know, question for you. So, you know, having laminar flow over 90% of a wing, as you're talking about, is unheard of in business aviation. So what innovations, like, around geometry, manufacturing, flight controls? I'm sure there's a lot of elements of this that allows you to move from, you know, wind tunnel and computer testing to something certifiable.
Yeah. So I'll start with three pieces that we believe converged. One of them is the analysis. If you go to analyze an airplane, you have to know what your drag is. If you don't, it's like building a building and you don't know what your foundation is. But the problem has been it's tough to predict laminar flow. So you can imagine a program starts, you're thinking you're going to get laminar flow, you make your prediction, you go into the wind tunnel and you're 20% off. And then you go back to your boss and say, I need to go to the wind tunnel again. And he says, wait a minute, is that wind tunnel, the wind tunnel that just cost me $20,000 an hour and the wind tunnel that we had to wait 2 years to get into, I have to do that again now? That's a program killer right there. So the first thing we did is we took the overflow code from NASA and we plugged on our own proprietary laminar flow algorithm.
Now, what's the overflow code? I'm not
it's
familiar
a CFD.
With that.
Excuse me. See, it's a computational fluids dynamic code that we plugged a subroutine onto that we created and owned with our gang, and we predicted the laminar flow within a couple percentage. So that really expensive wind tunnel test I went and did in Cologne and then up in Wichita State, the low speed one, we were dead nuts on our polar. So I didn't have to go back to anybody and say, we need to go again for $20,000 an hour and wait 2 more years. So that's critical to understand. And then technology that everybody has today at their disposal was also necessary, and it wasn't there in the past. These darn NVIDIA graphic processing units that we all know about, processing AI and all that, that's what you need to run these huge laminar flow models. They have, you know, hundreds of millions of grids in it rather than the, you know, millions before. So that's a big first piece of it. And that allows you to do your special geometry. And I'll come back to that because I know you asked about that. The second thing we do is we manufacture it. So my mantra for everybody is design it in, build it in, keep it in. That's what you have to do to laminar flow if you want to be on my team. So the build it in part, we're using on our aero surfaces closed mold net shape composites methodologies based in resin transfer molding. And there's two forms of it. You can put dry fabric in the mold, inject it with resin, or you can put pre-pregged fabric in the mold and just make a dam with the resin. But if you came up to our wing tool and saw it sitting there ready to go in the press, it would look like a big black coffin. It's black anodized aluminum, and it goes into a press. It's a heated press. That resin gets injected in, and then it comes out, and you take the lid off, and the shape is there. You have very low waviness, determinate assembly on the next step when you go to put it on the aircraft, and you know what your steps and gaps are going to be. You know what your waviness is going to be, and those are critical to laminar flow. And John, I'll tell you, with your pilot background and your audience, think of the best analogy there. What is it? Well, why can you do that, Scott? And is that a brand new thing? It's not.
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask you, what is it about that method that you either some challenges you had to solve technically to make this work? How come other people aren't using this? Or maybe they are, but what's different
here? They just have been using it for different things. The LeapTech engines, the fan blades on the LeapTech engines, they're made from RTM, same place. I just had a customer of mine. We were a customer of theirs at Bell, and then I became a consultant for them. They you know, Radius Engineering, CoExpair, these guys that have mastered this technique. Others do it too. But we just saw it as the means to answer avoiding drag. You know, the stealth guys do all this stuff, no waviness, no steps and gaps, but they're trying to avoid radar. We're doing those same methodologies trying to avoid drag. So that's another one. We're also using Toray's most advanced material, the T1100 system, to get our weight, keep our weight down below 19,000 pounds. And then the third thing is keep it in. What does that mean? It means that you can't operate the aircraft that comes off the line with laminar flow and loses it 5 days later because of bugs, abrasion, or whatever else. And the way we've overcome that is we're going to use coatings. You know, Formula One's got some interesting coatings there. The paint manufacturers do. NASA's worked on anti-bug hydrophobic coatings. But the number one thing you got to do is go high. So we fly at 51,000 feet for our cruise altitude. And the reason we do that is because the Reynolds number is low up there. The Reynolds number is a combination of the fluid viscosity that you're in and the geometry that you're flying through it. So the lower you get it, the more laminar flow you get. And it turns out the more resilient that laminar flow is to indications that might have happened on your leading edge or elsewhere during your operational life.
Hey, Scott, what makes it more resilient up there, up higher?
It's that when we didn't stumble on it, because innovation is never really about stumbling. You got your eyes closed, you're looking through the bushes, but it's about a directed intellectual opportunity. And we found that we were in a wind tunnel with a specimen, a laminar flow wing specimen, and we noticed some turbulent flow wedges opening up at one of our altitudes. It was about 30,000 feet equivalent pressure altitude. And we said, oh, that's weird, but maybe this is an opportunity. Let's see what happens when we go up in altitude to those turbulent wedges. We go up to 40, which is reducing the Reynolds number, and the wedges start to close up. We go out up to 51, they disappear. So that resilience comes from that lower Reynolds number that you can achieve at that higher altitude with a given geometry.
Well, that also gives you above the jet streams too. So there's an added benefit of being up that high too.
Yeah.
Plus, it's a beautiful view.
Hey, oh, yeah. It's gorgeous up there. And you, I mean, you flew stuff that had tons of power on your side, but we have to fly something that's not so overpowered. So why do we love it up there? Because a lot of airplanes, they'll brag about going up there, but it's mushy as all get out. None of the pilots want to stay up there. Laminar flow creates a what we call a big dumb wing. So we have very low wing loading, and our wing is clean. There's no canoes. All our actuation is embedded inside the cross section. And so now you've got low wing loading, a big wing area that goes, you know, goes hand in hand. So your balanced field length performance is 3,500 feet. That's like twice as many airports as a normal super mid can get into. We can climb direct to 51,000 in like 30 minutes. So you're humming up there. And then when you get up there, that big dumb wing is solid. And everyone says, well, that's a problem, though. Nobody makes big wings because they're really draggy. And we're like, yep, that's true, except in laminar flow. So our wing is big and dumb. It disappears. And dumb is an exaggeration. Josh is probably trying to dialing back in, telling me not to say that. But that's our nickname for it. The drag disappears. So the L in that L over D equation we were talking about before, it's there, and it's there in abundance because we have low wing loading, high wing area, and the drag is disappeared by a factor of 5 versus turbulent flow wings because we're in laminar flow in that cruise condition. So that's the beautiful thing. It's a little bit counterintuitive when you see that wing. You're like, that thing looks draggy, but it's not.
Because of the flow. And, you know, you decided to do this clean sheet, you know, start with this versus the Solera. What are some of the trade-offs or risks in approaching this the way you did it, not only in building the airplane, but with certification?
Yeah. So the first big one was the speed. You know, we had to make sure we could still get laminar flow at transonic speeds. That we'll be the first people to do that, and we've done it. We just got to build it and show everybody. But certification is always on my mind. I've been involved with a half a dozen commercial certifications over my time at Bell and a few military ones as well. And I greatly respect the process. It's humbled me in a good way because it removed any pride that I had or arrogance that I had about my capability. But what we have here, though, is Part 25 certification. Part 23.
Yep.
Part 23 certification. That is 19,000 pounds, 9 passengers and below. And the Part 23 framework for this type of aircraft is completely defined. We will barely have a special condition. We know exactly what we have to do to write our certification basis. The FAA already declared nothing new and novel on our aircraft, which for a guy like me stung for a little bit, but only for a little bit, about 5 seconds.
Well, from an FAA perspective, you love not new and novel.
Love it.
Because it means you actually get to keep progressing quickly.
Exactly. And, you know, this takes me back to your question, like, what did I see when I first saw the program and the aircraft? I saw physics and Mother Nature on our side with a problem that just needed great engineers and great businessmen and women to come together and solve it. And that's one of the things that, you know, I fought physics a little bit on some of my other innovative stuff that I worked on. And that's always fun, too. You're trying to increase TRL levels and so forth. But this was solid. And it had a solid certification path that's well-defined. Part 23, as you probably know, was rewritten for as a performance-based specification, which is to our advantage. Because, you know, when it's really prescriptive, it kind of always limits you. And 25 and the helicopter parts are still pretty prescriptive. So that's great. We'll port some stuff down from 25 because our customers are used to certain things like bird strike resilience and you know, we're going to 51,000 feet, so we'll put an extra load factor on it up there. But I'm really happy about that. And then the second piece of that puzzle, though, John, is we decided to use as much commercial off the shelf as we could. So that means the Williams FJ44, it's a plug-in, and the aircraft's ready to go. The ECS system, landing gear is just modified COTS, fuel system is COTS. Our bespoke piece is the structures, and that's always bespoke on a new aircraft program. And then our aerodynamics. But the aerodynamics, what's interesting is the FAA looks at laminar flow aerodynamics in the same way as they look at turbulent flow. We have to have control power on the aircraft's aerodynamic surfaces to counteract asymmetric gusts or asymmetric laminar versus turbulent flowing. Just the same thing that we do in every aircraft. Your control powers are there for the environment you're going to operate in. So they don't look at it as a safety thing. The laminar flow piece is for the company to have or not to have and succeed because of the efficiencies. They don't need any new rules to help us define that. So that's the other beautiful part of it as well.
So my understanding of laminar flow, how does your wing handle at high angles attack, close to stall?
Yeah.
P-51 is kind of a famous laminar flow. It changed the war because of what laminar flow did for the performance of that aircraft. But it was also sometimes challenging in the landing configuration. So I'd love for you to speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. So ours is, I think if you looked at the P-51 and the Celera, you'd probably find more similar characteristics in that airfoil shape and wing shape. We came off of that kind of they sometimes call it a Cat NLF category or a laminar flow category airfoil shape, and we went to a more slotted two-piece shape. So now we have a fore element of the wing and an aft element of the wing that those which form the flaps and the ailerons like everything else, but there's no Fowler motion back there for us.
Okay.
It's just a simple drop hinge, and that the slot in between energizes the flow and pulls the laminar flow back far on the top and lower surface. And then what's really
interesting... So you're maintaining the laminar flow as you put the flaps down the way you designed it. Is that...
Yeah, well, so when we went to we went to 26 degrees angle of attack in the mm-hmm. low-speed wind tunnel test, and that aft element was hanging on the whole time. So instead of this precipitous drop,
right,
it was just kind of gradually went down.
Okay.
Because the aft element was hanging in there with us. Now, it's not stall resistant or anything like that. It's just it has a more benign characteristic rather than that dramatic drop off that we're used to at a certain angle of attack.
That's fascinating. And so in this war against drag, Windows lost out. So one of the other one of the things that you're doing, though, that I think the industry is fascinated with is the supernatural vision system. And I've seen, if you guys go to Otto Aerospace, right? OttoAerospace.com, and you can see pictures of this. Can you talk about not only, okay, you made a decision to go windowless. Yeah. I'm sure that you got some customer feedback, right? The people's experience, their trust, being able to see outside. Talk to us about this decision, because it's a beautiful design element of the airplane.
Yeah. Well, I'll start from the end in a funny little story, because people asked us all the time, did you check with your customers? Are they going to want this? And da da da. And we had to stay so tight-lipped about the deal with Flexjet until we announced it. And then I just had a relief valve. He's like, yeah, we checked with our customer. He bought 300 of them, and that's exactly what he wants. No windows. And now going back to the original design piece, because he wasn't with us at that moment, but you've got this elliptical-shaped fuselage, and it's a laminar flow shape. It's not all the laminar flow. The wing is way more.
And the cabin is, a 6.5-foot cabin?
Yeah, 6'5".
What a differentiator between other platforms, too.
Yep. And then that triggered something in our head. We can offer a better customer experience. So how do we do that? And that's where, instead of natural windows, we think about it as digital windows, supernatural vision. These are 72 inches long, 21 inches high. When you sit in our mock-up of it, we have a Class B mock-up of it here in Fort Worth. You should come down and check it out with us. It's like a world cinematic view. No more craning out the windows. You just sit up straight and tall in your seat, and you look out into the world. If you're choosing that mode, the live camera feed, and the cameras are super high resolution, we stitch the image together with more NVIDIA GPU cards, and we project it on these gorgeous 4K, 8K OLEDs that are curved and as part of the walls, and you can look outside, do a Zoom meeting, entertain yourself with Netflix. We have lights that are on the panel, so you can make all your different lighting decisions, mood lighting, darkness, black shades. It's a digital, you could make the inside of the cabin look like it had real windows if somebody was, preferred that, because it's just a digital platform. And we hired a team from Apple to help us do this. They we've got guys leaving Gulfstream and Cessna, but leaving Apple to come and do this Dr. Craig Lewiston's on our team and leading SNV. He knows how to make the human experience and the machine experience work together so people don't get sick. He knows how to, you know, create the right imagery, and he's going to create an operating system that even, you know, maybe third-party apps can write code on it, and you could have a unique as unique a iPhone as you have on your airplane inside the supernatural vision system. So then what happens outside? So really, that's our big bogey there: best customer experience, not only the size but the digital experience. But then, as you mentioned, it lowers excrescence drag. It doesn't help a ton with laminar flow, but keeps the excrescence drag down. But what's the most important part? Because everybody just takes this for granted. A window represents you poking a hole in a pressure vessel that is sustaining your life at 30, 40,000 feet. It's a bad thing to do. So, and it's also costly to manufacture. So we've increased the safety now. We have less, crack path failures of system safety and failure modes because there are no holes. We have less weight because there's no doublers around those holes and frames around those holes. So it's a great safety feature as well as the customer experience feature and performance feature in reducing excrescence drag.
Speak to how that impacts the manufacturing process.
Oh yeah, so if you get a chance and go to one of these bigger aerostructures houses and watch them make a fuselage, it's a wonder how they do the tube, right? And you're watching it going, man, that looks easy. They're wrapping these tools with fabric and putting the frames in, and you think, oh, no problem. And then if you watch it on the next step when they have to cut the cut the window out and then frame it out. And now you start getting fasteners, you start getting opportunities for the edges to, you know, not come out the right way, and you have to repair them. It's a difficult process that costs a lot of money.
Well, yeah, and you know, one of the things you're doing, a lot of companies talk about, you know, digital twins, model-based design. How are you embracing that as not only designing the airplane, but through certification and entry into service?
Yeah, thanks for that question too, man. I've been obsessed with digital first and digital enterprise for a long time, but unfortunately, I think our industry's been sort of paying lip service to it or just finding very, you know, small applications. What we're doing is we're saying we have to have virtual twins, digital twins of every aircraft we make, of our entire factory, and all of the processes therein. And so we're starting.
So if I heard you right, it's not just the airplane, it's the entire manufacturing process. Everything is going to be replicated digitally. So I'm thinking about, you know, if you think of good design, right, it's you know, the customer input, it's the aircraft design, it's the service, you know, it's the manufacturing and the maintenance. All of these have to work together because if I figure out afterwards, I can't manufacture this or it's too hard to maintain, then going back and making a design change after the fact now gets very expensive. It can kill a program.
Nightmare. Yep. And recurring costs always eat your lunch, right? And then in manufacturing, so you got to do it early, like you just said. And then maintenance ruins your customer's experience if there's too much. And we've also changed that. And I want to talk to you about that too. But yes, you nailed it. Our digital first approach means end-to-end product lifecycle from design to cert to build to maintenance to retirement. And we're going to know in a digital world about all the data that's in there. And we're going to use it to predict things like maintenance events. So we put a spare on target and labor on target so that the aircraft comes in and that labor gets done scheduled rather than unscheduled, or rather than creating an AOG event. You know, a lot of manufacturers, they love revenue in the aftermarket. Paul and I despise it because our customers make money and we make money when the aircraft flies. That's it. So we're trying to increase availability as well. And that's in our our maintainability program and be predictive when we need to be. And we'll use a health monitoring system on there. That's also part of this digital first approach. There's going to be data flowing off the aircraft through our satellite internet that'll be on the aircraft, and it'll be analyzed ahead of time for the aircraft to be prepared or the maintainers to be prepared when it comes to ground. So yeah, digital first is there. And we've got a great leader, Obian Du, who's our chief information digital officer. He works closely with my team to create synergies between our CAD system, our PLM system, our manufacturing system, and our ERP system. We use Dassault primarily on the CAD and PLM and manufacturing side. Then we're going to we're looking at SAP on the ERP side, just working those last decisions now. And those two things will tie together to make for a complete product lifecycle digital awareness of the product. And then the part I love that you said, and I'll finish off with this, is when I think digital enterprise and digital first, I remember and remind my team the thing that comes out of the back end of what we're doing over the next 5 years. Yes, it's a product, but it's really knowledge. And if we capture that knowledge at the end of this 3500 program and loop it back to begin our next design, then we are all the much better for it. Was that aluminum stringer appropriate, or should we made it a composite? Was that the right mass flow in the ECS system, or should we have done something different there? You know, those are the things that I'm really looking forward to, is helping us make smarter, more informed decisions about the next design as well.
Well, let's do this then, as we kind of wrap up then. So imagine it's 2035, it's 10 years out.
Yeah.
The Phantom has succeeded.
Nice.
Right? It's out there. Yeah, right? It's entered the market. It's a success. What has changed 10 years out? Because this aircraft is now in service across charter operators, fractional operators, private owners. What's happened?
Yeah. Well, what's happened is we have preserved a natural resource that's extremely important to our economy. You can go after the green or not green thing. I don't really care. Everybody, left, right, and center, wants to preserve our natural resources. And we've done that to the tune of 66%. So that's one thing. Cost of those operations that you just described have gone down. Fuel burn, maintenance, build, and therefore it allows more people to fly in that format. And so it becomes a question of accessibility. Then the next thing that'll happen in 35 is we'll be starting to come out with our next larger aircraft. And we hope that that aircraft touches the commercial space more than the private space. And now we're really allowing, you know, big operations to save tons of money and allow other people to fly in a different format that's more enjoyable. So that's what I look forward to. I mean, specific cases, a big fleet operator could stand to save hundreds of millions of dollars in fuel burn alone from just a laminar flow aircraft. So you can imagine what that translates to in big commercial operations.
Well, it translates to a bigger fleet, more uptime. Yeah, bigger fleet, more uptime, more availability, more profitability, lower ticket, you know, more lower charter costs. Like there's a lot of, you know, as you follow out what that could be.
Our, you know, Flexjet, Ken, he loves the availability figure we're chasing down. We're trying to be more like a commercial, 98-99% instead of this, you know, 70% that's out there on business jets today. And that's exactly what he said to us when we told him about that. He's like, you're adding aircraft to my fleet virtually. And he's right, because, you know, he runs 1,000 to 1,200 hours a year. And we bump that availability up by 15%, 20%. And he's added, you know, a dozen aircraft to his operational availability. So it's great.
Well, that's awesome. Well, Scott, thank you so much for being on today. This has been incredible. You love to have you back on. You know, if you had some big milestones, want to talk about something that's coming up, have a big announcement, our audience would love to hear about any updates that's happening at Otto. So.
Oh, man, thanks, John. I appreciate that. What a great format you have here. It feels real comfortable to talk to somebody as knowledgeable as you, and I'm sure your audience is the same. So thank you for having us on board.
Absolutely, man. Keep knocking them alive out there.
I will.
All right.
Take it easy. Bye.